from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, this is Forum. I'm Joshua Johnson, sitting in for Michael Krasny. The products that come from Silicon Valley serve the world, but the workforce of Silicon Valley is not as diverse as the world it serves. Newly published demographics from major tech companies prove what many of us suspected. The tech sector is a boys' club, and mostly a white boys' club at that. What can Silicon Valley companies, its consumers, and others take to increase diversity here? What factors are behind the current trend? And for that matter, what difference does it make? Is this business really about matters of black, white, red, yellow, and brown? Or do investors just care about green? We'll spend the hour exploring diversity in Silicon Valley next on Forum after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, this is Forum. Good morning. I'm Joshua Johnson of KQED News, sitting in for Michael Krasny. It is what the world thinks of the Bay Area's tech workers. Maybe you saw it, too, in a recent episode of the HBO comedy series Silicon Valley.
They always travel in groups of five.
These programmers, there's always a tall, skinny white guy.
Short, skinny Asian guy. Fat guy with a ponytail. Some guy with crazy facial hair. And then an East Indian guy. It's like they trade guys until they all have the right group.
You clearly have a great understanding of humanity.
So the right group has no black people, no Hispanic people, no women? That stereotype is bearing itself out in newly published demographic data from major companies like Google, Apple, Facebook, and LinkedIn. The trend goes like this. White men predominate, followed by Asian men. Women are about 30% of the overall workforce, despite being 50% of the U.S. population. Hispanics are about 3% of the workforce, blacks 2%. In short, not much resemblance to the customers they serve. Still, even the companies say they want to improve the balance. In this hour of Forum, we'll talk openly and candidly about diversity in Silicon Valley and what can be done to mix things up a bit. We welcome your questions, your thoughts, and especially your stories of working in tech. Joining us in the studio are Eric Abrams. He is the Director of Diversity Initiatives at UC Berkeley's Haas School of Business. Eric, good morning.
Good morning, Joshua. It's good to be here.
Good to have you. Also here in the studio is Danilo Campos, a mobile product designer. He has built apps for iPhones and iPads since 2008. Danilo, welcome.
Thank you for having me.
And Nicole Sanchez is founder and CEO of Vaya Consulting. Her company advises tech firms on diversity in hiring. Nicole, glad to have you today.
Thanks for having me.
Nicole, I'm going to start with you, and I'm going to start with the hardcore question first, just to put it out there. How much of this picture, this lack of certain kinds of diversity, is the result of unspoken racism in Silicon Valley? Should we just use the R word, or is it more complex than that?
Oh, I'm always up for using the R word. It is complex, but it is deeply rooted generations of institutionalized racism here in the United States that manifests itself in on the ground in a way that I think people wouldn't call racism the way that they've been taught racism, sort of looking back in the 60s and the civil rights struggle.
Jim Crow racism.
Yeah, and so it's easy to point to Jim Crow racism and say, well, we're not that. However, the numbers don't bear out that a whole lot has changed. So now we're talking about things like hidden bias, microaggressions, things that are actually perfectly legal but still shut people of color, the LGBT community, out from accessing jobs and capital in the tech ecosystem.
So these are not the outright de facto and de jure forms of racism that we're used to from watching Eyes on the Prize, but this is the manifestation, perhaps, of decades and decades later of the aftermath, the ripple effects from that.
Yeah. Well, I wouldn't be so naive as to say that that other stuff doesn't still exist, because it absolutely does. I mean, just because we're in Silicon Valley doesn't mean we aren't paying attention to Ferguson, Missouri, where that's absolutely what's going on. But Silicon Valley really prides itself on being a quote-unquote meritocracy and believes that they're hiring the best and the brightest. But if that were the case, the numbers would look very different. So again, people on the hiring front, on the retention front, on the promotion front, are probably doing things that are perfectly legal and yet are not bearing the fruit we'd really like to see.
Eric Abrams, I want to get your reaction to a clip from the Reverend Jesse Jackson. He spoke at Google's shareholder meeting this year out of concern for the lack of people of color in a variety of positions there. It's part of the reason why this latest release of data from Google, Twitter, Apple, Facebook, LinkedIn, and others has been released. His point was that companies cannot be great until they actively demand diversity among their ranks.
We did not know how good baseball could be until everybody could play. Do not know how good Google can be until all of us can be a part of that search. And if you can't find people now, search for them.
Eric, what do you make of that?
Well, I think he's absolutely right. And I think that there are a number of steps that companies and firms and organizations could take to improve the diversity of their staff. It seems like there are opportunities for tech companies to invest in underrepresented talent. And it's not just hiring from a limited pool, it's also investing in education for underrepresented folks, for LGBT folks, apprenticeship programs, mentorship programs, programs like Spark, for example.
What's Spark?
Spark is an internship program and a mentorship program to encourage young people to get involved in tech and to learn how to code and that sort of thing.
Danilo, what's your, since you've worked in tech for a number of years, what's your most vivid experience of working in tech as it related to your ethnicity? You're Puerto Rican, born in Puerto Rico. How much of an impact, if any, has that had?
So I think that, you know, I echo Nicole's view that a lot of this is about subtlety. Getting work in this industry has at times been challenging because my route into my work has been fairly non-traditional. You know, if you looked at my childhood, it should have been incredibly obvious to everyone that, you know what, this kid's going to grow up, he's going to work in technology, this is what he loves. But the complication for me is that I didn't have access to folks who had college education to kind of guide me down a path that would lead me to an easy case to make for getting these sorts of jobs. So, you know, I had to teach myself software development and I had to...
You're self-taught.
I am, yeah. Because I knew that that was the only way to get to the kind of stuff that I wanted to be able to do. So what I have found is that in hiring, people are looking for carbon copies of themselves. So people who have gone to a particular kind of school, people who have gotten a computer science degree. And so being unable to kind of make the appropriate, you know, noises related to telling people I can do this stuff has made it very challenging at points to be taken seriously in the interview process.
So you kind of had a number of challenges, it sounds like, not the least of which was the fact that you did not come up in tech through a particular university route where there was an alumni network that could help to vouch for you and kind of work your way in. And then on top of that was the whole race, ethnicity, culture thing.
Yeah, absolutely. Lacking the network to kind of open doors, vouch for me, that kind of stuff is very challenging. And so what I had to do was produce sufficient body of work on my own to establish my credibility. And, you know, I think that it's instructive because since then I have shipped work to millions of users. I've had recognition in the press for the kind of work that I do. So having a computer science degree is not necessary at points to do great work in this industry. There's a bunch of different ways that you can show up and be a solid contributor.
I can imagine somebody listening might think, well, then the meritocracy worked. You taught yourself, you created a product, and you began to get work. I presume you're working as a designer now. It worked. What's the problem?
The challenge is all the time invested in trying to find opportunities and not necessarily being taken seriously because I don't have the certain earmarks that people are looking for to say, hey, this person is to be taken seriously. So for me, coming up into this work was coming up from behind in a deficit. And it's been very interesting to see how, you know, say folks who have substantially less experience than I do can sometimes pull higher salaries, can more easily, you know, get jobs. There's some challenges in coming up from behind like this.
We're discussing diversity in Silicon Valley with Eric Abrams of UC Berkeley, mobile designer Danilo Campos, and Nicole Sanchez of Via Consulting. We'd love you to join the conversation. Call us, 866-733-6786. That's 866-733-6786. Email us. The address is forum@kqed.org. You can also find us on Facebook or tweet us. We are at KQED Forum. I should note two things at this point before we continue the conversation. First of all, this program is a safe space to discuss a very tough Subject. If there is something on your mind and you're not quite sure how to say it, I'd rather you call in, say it, and trust us to be empathetic than not say it and carry with you the same thoughts that you wish you had a chance to just say without getting smacked down for it. We will not smack you down for it. We really do welcome all points of view. Secondly, we did invite Google, Apple, Facebook, and Twitter to be part of the conversation. We did not hear back from them in terms of being part of this forum conversation, although Apple did respond to our initial reporting about the release of their diversity data earlier in this week. So they weren't able to be part of this program, but Apple at least has been responsive to us in our reporting on this. Nicole Sanchez, I heard you mention the term microaggressions. Mm-hmm. That's come up in a previous program, and all five of the phone lines have already lit up. This is going to be a good hour. I heard you mention the term microaggressions yes. earlier. That came up in an earlier forum program we did a few weeks ago about LGBT gamers.
Yes.
Would you redefine that term for us, Guy? I have a feeling it's going to come up a lot in this
sure.
hour.
I think microaggressions is a really powerful and in some ways lovely way of describing what a lot of us have experienced over the years. We just didn't have that word for it for a very long time. Mm-hmm. It's the subtle message that you don't belong. It is aggression. Letting you know that you are other, you are an outsider compared to me and my crew. And the micro part means that it's incessant, small, it's death by a thousand cuts, mm-hmm. as opposed to a single stroke of a fire hose, of a dog, of a police officer. It's words that always let you know that there's something a little different about you and we see it.
Give me an example.
Okay. So, yeah, I think actually BuzzFeed put out a couple of really hilarious videos about if black people said to white people what white people said to black people. It's a perfect example of microaggression. So it's things that sound innocuous, like your hair. It's so lovely. Can I touch it? White Ooh. Person to black person. Yeah. No, the answer is no, you may not touch it. And every
sidebar on peril of your life.
On peril of your life.
No.
And every black person that we know, including probably those of you in this room, have a story about a conversation about hair. But nobody said anything awful. That's not bad. That's not rude. I didn't say your hair was ugly.
And it's probably an honest question that comes from a place
there
of just wanting to get to know somebody, of trying to be that person who is not aggressive, who is not discriminatory and definitely not racist, and that probably comes from a very reasonable place.
That's right. And I'll tell you why I did come through the education institutions that make me very hireable in Silicon Valley. And that is where I faced some of the most intense microaggressions. Things like, your last name Sanchez, we know how you got into this school. I don't think it's fair that my parents pay full tuition where yours don't. Things like that where you go, okay, you just stated your opinion, but I'll tell you what, you're the millionth person to say that to me. You're not the only person who said that to me. You're the 100th or the 1,000th.
Eric Abrams, how do you deal with students at UC Berkeley Haas in terms of teaching them how to comport themselves in the world of business in a world that is increasingly multinational, multi-ethnic, multicultural, multi-orientation, especially kids who may be bright, definitely mean well, but they don't know where to start or what to say.
Certainly. And that's something that we spend a lot of time at Haas thinking about and talking about. And one of the things we're trying to do is encourage students to join some of our affinity groups that are not their own. I can give you a great example. We have a young man who's a graduate of the military, U.S. Military Academy, has served tours overseas, proudly identifies himself as a conservative Republican. And one of the first things he did as a student at Haas was to join our Women in Leadership group because he realized he needed to learn about how to work with women. That's one thing we're trying to encourage lots of our students to do is go ahead and join an affinity group. You know, you don't have to be an African-American student to join the Black Business Students Association. You don't have to be an LGBT student to join Queer at Haas. But it is an awesome opportunity to learn about people who are different than yourself.
And what do you talk to the students about in terms of the dollars and cents value of diversity in a company? I mean, I tend to think that the color that most companies are really worried about is green. How does diversity actually impact a company's bottom line?
Well, I think it impacts a company's bottom line because of something that we often don't talk about enough in the conversation about diversity. Usually when we bring up diversity, people immediately go to skin color, gender, sexual orientation. The sort of diversity that can help a company make more money certainly has a lot to do with that, but it's intellectual diversity. It's not just about how people look. It's about how they think. Mm-hmm. And having people who come from different backgrounds, who come from different organizations, who have different faiths, can really help a company solve problems in ways that a homogenous group would not.
And I think to the point that you're making about various kinds of diversity, an email comment kind of speaks to that. Anne writes, I hope you address age in your discussion of diversity in the tech workplace. Doubtless that the data, if it were culled from tech companies, would show a woefully slanted range of ages to those in their 20s and 30s among their workforce. Let's dive in with some of the phone calls, starting with Sen in Palo Alto. Sen, good morning.
Good morning.
What's on your mind?
So I have three comments for the three things that you've been speaking about. So first, I would like to draw a comparison between the demography of the students in the classroom, especially in tech classrooms like computer science, electronics, electrical, whatever. And you'll see the numbers that you're speaking of is kind of similar, right? The second thing I would like to say is if there were any racism, if there were a lot of racism in this industry, then you wouldn't find so many immigrant workers actually working in these big companies. Like 30% of the Asian population, among that I would say like 70% are immigrants. And the third thing I would like to say is, if you are in any industry, say finance, say banking, whatever, if you have a good resume, that definitely helps you, right? Because that's the only thing you know about the person up front when you are interviewing somebody. So if you're from a good school, of course, that will add to your benefit. And if you don't have any background in this field of work, it's not going to be that helpful. Because unless you have something to show for yourself, it's very difficult to judge you in a 45-minute interview process. I don't think there is a lot of racism here. There might be some subtle racism, like once you get hired, if you're from a good school, like a top-tier school like Stanford or Berkeley or Carnegie Mellon, your salaries might be a bit higher than somebody who gets hired from mid-tier school. It tends to even itself out if you are really good at your work.
Sen, thanks for the comment. I'm going to let Nicole Sanchez respond to that.
Well, I really appreciate you saying that because I think this is the prevailing sentiment in a lot of companies in Silicon Valley, what the caller just said. But on the point, for example, of resumes, if you just have a good resume, then that's going to be enough. It's actually not true. There is a very famous study of comparative resumes sent with different names at the top of the header. The names were Emily, Greg, Lakeisha, and Jamal. And I think, unfortunately, a lot of us know how that bore out. Almost identical in terms of type of school, education, and that sort of thing. And Emily and Greg got huge callbacks, and Lakeisha and Jamal got very few. And so the implicit biases that are embedded in the selection before you even get to have an interview are there and very present. I recently, for several years, worked at the Kapor Center for Social Impact, and Dr. Frida Kapor Klein, is a pioneer in researching hidden bias in the workplace and how these kinds of things manifest themselves to talk about not even getting your foot in the door, even if you have these things on your resume. It's very prescient, and there's a lot of research to back that up.
Eric Abrams?
There's just one thing I wanted to point out that the caller said that I thought was really interesting. He mentioned that if there was racism in Silicon Valley, there wouldn't be so many Asian American employees or employees of South Asian descent. And that's an argument that has come up on more than one occasion. The first time I really heard it was in an op-ed piece by Vivek Ranadive, the founder of TIBCO, the owner of the Sacramento Kings basketball team, wrote a long opinion piece in the San Jose Mercury News about how he felt that Silicon Valley was a pure meritocracy, that, you know, he arrived with a couple of dollars in his pocket and was able to build this billion-dollar company. And that's a wonderful story. And there are stories, many, many stories like that in Silicon Valley. And I don't want to take those efforts or minimize those in any way. Having said that, just because folks from one demographic have been successful, it doesn't mean that folks from a number of demographics can be equally successful. People do tend to hire people they're familiar with and people they understand. If there are large numbers of employees at a company who did their undergraduate work at one of the, you know, outstanding Indian Institutes of Technology, they might be more likely to hire folks who went to that school. If there were more folks who had done their engineering work at Morehouse College or Hampton or University of Texas El Paso, they might be more likely to hire. Unfortunately, we don't have as many from those schools.
We're going to broaden the conversation briefly. Joining us on the phone now is Eric Moore, the managing director of Base Ventures, a VC firm based in Berkeley. Eric, good morning.
Good morning.
I'm wondering how you view this issue in terms of diversity when it comes to dealing with companies as a venture capital fund. It's very different than just hiring a programmer to work for an established company. How, if at all, does diversity play into some of the decisions you make on how to invest people's money?
Absolutely. So first and foremost, at our fund, we strive to find the best companies that we think are going to perform well and give our investors in our fund the biggest and best return. So that is the first window in which we look at companies. So with that, we see as do most venture capitalists, we see and meet with quite a few startups. And with that prism, you know, when we happen to find a company that is run by an African American or a female, we don't necessarily look at it any differently. But as it turns out, we have found some great companies that are run by African Americans. In fact, about 40% of our portfolio are companies that have founders that are black or women. So we're happy and excited about what we have. And in fact, those companies are performing very well and on par with the majority companies. So we're excited about it.
I remember I first encountered you in a panel here in San Francisco about blacks in tech. And I remember you made a fairly strong comment about, and I don't want to mischaracterize you, so please feel free to correct me, but about your view on being black in tech and on the need to kind of temper that somewhat with a focus on who's got the best idea, who's going to give us the best return, which companies can we work with the most ably. I don't know if I said that quite right, but could you rearticulate that?
That's fair, yeah. I mean, we really want to find, like I said earlier, the best companies. And as we see companies, as we find companies that are anything, that are black or white, how can we be helpful to these guys? How can we, propel them to the next level and make sure that they are performing at a level that is acceptable and will eventually, exit at a phenomenal multiple. So we want to make sure that these people are great, and as such, it's not necessarily a focus on race or a focus on gender, but it's founders who we think are capable and outstanding and do things a little bit out of the box, and so we really really want to focus on not the color, but the fact that these guys are smart and good.
And briefly, what about for you, being an African-American who works in the world of venture capital? I have to confess, you were the first black VC I had ever met when I met you at the Blacks in Tech panel. I don't know if that just means I don't get out enough, but I don't see many people who look like you and me in that world.
Yeah, that's fair. So there are quite a few black people that work in venture capital at firms, but we've been told, and I think it's true, but in the Valley, we are the only ones. We are the only fund that is run by, African Americans, and so we essentially went out and raised money from other limited partners, and we run the fund ourselves and we make all the decisions. So I think we are the only ones in the Valley that do it. It's unfortunate in that here it is 2014. There are no others who are doing what we do in the Valley. I know that there are other people thinking about it or talking about it, but I think we're actually the only ones that are. In fact, we're in the process right now of raising our second fund. So
right.
You don't raise a second fund unless your first fund has done very well.
Exactly. So, Eric Moore is the managing director of Base Ventures, a VC firm based in Berkeley. Eric, I appreciate you chiming in. Thanks for talking to us.
Thank you.
Time for a break. When we come back, we'll continue our conversation on diversity in Silicon Valley with Eric Abrams of UC Berkeley, mobile designer Danilo Campos, and Nicole Sanchez of Via Consulting. I'm Joshua Johnson. Glad you're with us today. This is Forum from KQED Public Radio. This is Forum from KQED Public Radio. I'm Joshua Johnson, sitting in for Michael Krasny. We're discussing diversity in Silicon Valley with Eric Abrams of UC Berkeley, mobile designer Danilo Campos, and Nicole Sanchez of Via Consulting. Feel free to call us, 866-733-6786. Email us, forum@kqed.org. Find us on Facebook or tweet us. We are at KQED Forum. Before we dive into the conversation, I want to go to an email that we got from a while ago because it involves something that I was remiss in not saying. Eunice writes, I just heard the promo for the diversity segment at 10. It went something like just what we suspected most people at Apple are white and male. No diversity. I highly resent the fact that you would group in Asian people and say they do not add diversity. I work at a tech company, but I would dispute the fact that I, as a Korean-American who grew up in the Midwest, am in the same cohort as a white male, or as the Chinese national down the hall who came to the U.S. for grad school, or as the Indian woman downstairs who grew up in England and was transferred here from the London branch. Why are we not considered to add diversity to the workplace? Eunice, good point, and I was remiss in not mentioning at the top of the show that we did invite more guests of Asian descent to be part of the panel. They were not able to be part of the conversation. However, joining us now on the line is a guest of Pakistani descent. We'll get to her in just a moment. Before we do that, I know that there were a few people here in the studio who wanted to make a few points, starting with Danilo Campos.
So I'm thrilled that Sen launched with the questions that he did. I'd like to address a couple of pieces. One of them is that actually when you look at the computer science graduates, you know, the National Science Foundation pegs the number of black computer science grads at about 10%. And when we look at a company, you know, like Google or Facebook or Twitter, that representation is closer to 1%. National Science Foundation gives us 8% for Latino computer science graduates. Again, we're seeing small fractions of that represented in the largest of tech companies. So that piece is important. The other piece that's important to talk about is that it's not enough to have a great resume, because the definition of a great resume can be very narrow, especially by Google standards, for example. I never could have gotten a job at Google, because one of the things that Google had been selecting for a very long time, they were looking at SAT scores. Now, when we look at SAT scores, they don't show any correlation with job outcomes. They don't show any correlation with computer science or technical aptitude. The biggest correlation that we see with SAT scores is family income. So, you know, you have organizations that are very quietly selecting out everyone but the folks who are going to the most elite schools who have the most opportunities for access in their youth. And that shuts out a whole lot of folks who aren't necessarily coming from the most prosperous of origins.
Before Nicole speaks, I want to get to a few of our online comments. Great comments. Keep them coming. One listener wrote, as a tech consultant who's worked at Silicon Valley's largest companies, I can tell you that the death by a thousand cuts is a huge issue. Institutional discrimination comes in many forms. Edwin writes by email, by focusing on tech skills, companies are leaving out qualified applicants of color. There are so many jobs at Google, Facebook, etc., that do not require tech skills. I'm a black man with a master's degree in journalism. I've applied for jobs I'm clearly qualified for in communication departments at these companies, but I've never received even a single call. And another listener tweeted us, good products require understanding your customer. Latinos are now the target customer. Where are the Latino tech entrepreneurs? Mm-hmm. Nicole Sanchez.
I'll tell you exactly where they are, and we're a growing community. I'm really excited to introduce folks to things like Monos Accelerator, which is the only Latino-focused tech accelerator run out of Google for entrepreneurs.
Manos, M-A-N-O-S?
Manos, M-A-N-O-S. That's a great place to look. Latino Startup Alliance, another great place to look. Sabio, S-A-B-I-O dot L-A, is a great thing down in Southern California that's training people for tech jobs now. And one of my favorite programs is at a cooperation between Hartnell College and Cal State Monterey Bay, which is an accelerated computer science degree that targets people from the Central Valley who predominantly come from farmworking families, some of whom are documented, some of whom are not. And they are just churning out the most amazing computer scientists and enthusiastic folks who are just really going to be the next wave of entrepreneurs. So there aren't enough yet, but those are some pockets to look for to really get excited about in Silicon Valley. The thing I actually wanted to say before was to Eunice and her point about Asians, which is absolutely correct. We do a poor job of putting all Asians in one group, from Indian to Chinese. I mean, it's a ridiculous notion. The thing to know about the demographics in the United States is that depending on country of origin, Asians in their trajectory through education and through income either mirror that of their white peers or that of their Latino peers, and it's predictable along lines of country of origin. And so it's a really important part of our discussion on diversity that often gets left out. And so I also want to thank Eunice for pointing that out.
Go ahead, Eric.
I was just going to say, I think that's a tremendous point. You know, it's been said before, but a Hmong kid who grew up in Fresno, the child of immigrants who did not speak a written language and went to Fresno State, doesn't really have a lot in common culturally with South Asian guy who went to one of the IIT campuses. So it's important to realize that, as Eunice said, when we talk about people of Asian descent, we're talking about people who've descended from about 60% of the world's population. There's a great deal of diversity there. Having said that, I would like to go back to something that Sen said earlier and also reflects on something that Nicole mentioned, and that is the idea of meritocracy. Well, who defines what merit is? I think it's really important to consider who defines what merit is. And if we look at merit just on SAT scores and high school and undergraduate GPAs, we'll have a very different view than if we look at merit as being based on height.
A height-based tech workforce. I'm 6'3", so I'm getting there. I'm going to be the CEO. Although, Eric, I think you're like, what, 6'5"?
6'5", right.
Okay, I'll be executive VP. Joining us on the phone now is Shaharoz Charania. She is the founder and CEO of Women 2.0. Shaharoz, good morning. Welcome to the program.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
Your experiences in tech, as I understand it, you're a woman of Pakistani descent?
Correct.
How has that, in terms of our conversation about people who are Asian, and I take the point very well about dealing with Asians as part of the diversity of Silicon Valley. They're considered diverse in context of the U.S. population, but here in Silicon Valley, it's not that uncommon to see people of Asian descent working in tech. How do we have that conversation intelligently?
Yeah, I mean, that's a really good question. I think Asians ourselves, besides the fact that we come from different places, even within our own groups, whether you're Pakistani or Indian, we ourselves don't understand ourselves because there's an old world and a new world. And I would say the old world and new world within diversity and across, the American population exists, and we don't understand ourselves, and that makes it a little bit more difficult. So I think it's just a diverse question. We don't have just issues of culture, but then there's issues of religion, there's issues of age and sexual orientation all within that. So I don't think there's a good answer.
What about the conversation related to women in tech? We haven't quite gone there yet, but since that's kind of your focus professionally, talk to me about where you see that now and where you'd like to see it go.
Sure. Yeah. So a very important piece. So when I first moved here coming on a decade ago, it was a very interesting place for me where I was shocked to be the only girl in the room at every networking event, the only girl in the room at the company that I worked at the time, a tech company, managing a group of 10 male engineers. And I thought, wow, there's something has to change here. And what we realized is at the end of the day, there's three parts where women are behind. One is their connections. And we talked about this earlier. It's not just about having a good resume. You also need to know people in Silicon Valley. It's a small community. So that was missing. The second piece that's really important is role models. Well, if I look to the top of any tech company now, and when I was growing up, my role models were Steve Jobs and Bill Gates. I'm not white, nor am I male, but I was excited about technology. And for me to look past that was difficult, but not everyone does that. Not everyone has the understanding that, okay, it doesn't matter that I didn't look like them. I can still be in tech. So role models are really important. And an important thing that we do at Women 2.0 is not always to talk about the issue, but to just put women in positions of power. Have them speak, have them showing that they are actually running companies or starting companies or leading at companies or funding companies, because they are, yes, in small numbers, but we need to create those role models, because that inspiration is what gives someone sort of the strength and the energy to go ahead and do something. And the third piece is, we talked about it earlier, is learning and education. And if we're talking about giving people a leg up, we do need to educate them. And our method is through stories, where people speak on panels, share keynote discussions, share workshops in a way that's, again, about the topic on hand. Oh, but by the way, the speaker that we have on our stage is a woman. And so these are the things that are important to bring this particular group of minority. It's weird to even call it a minority, to bring them forward. But that's what it is. We need to work on it. It goes back historically. And, just to bring up the old world and the new world, we as Women 2.0 align ourselves with the new world of investors, the new world of companies that don't see age, don't see race, don't see these types of minorities, and just look for good people and good products. And the reality is, the old world, like Nicole mentioned, comes historically, and they are trapped in a way of thinking, whether it's hidden bias or any other means that leads them to sort of unconsciously select out people.
Right.
And that's going to take time. That's going to take time to change. But in the meantime, we can align ourselves with people who aren't looking at these things and looking at meritocracy and moving forward.
Shaharoz Charania is founder and CEO of Women 2.0. Shaharoz, I appreciate your time. Thanks for talking to us.
Thank you.
An online comment now that also bears addressing. There's so much in this hour that bears addressing. Ken wrote to us online, how about including rampant age discrimination in this discussion? Where is an over 50 panel member that has worked in tech? Good point, Ken, and we have actually covered that before on Forum. We've done programs about allegations of age discrimination in Silicon Valley. If you go to our website, kqed.org/forum, you can search for those programs in our archive. So a good point. We have done those programs, and there's so many dimensions of this. There's absolutely no way we can get to it all, but we will get to as much as we can in the time that we have left. Speaking of which, let's go back to the phones with Jason in San Francisco. Jason, good morning.
Good morning. Thank you for having me on.
Sure. What's on your mind?
So I'm calling about two things. One is the applicant pool, and the second is high-income women. The first is I was a director at a high-tech company, and our applicants primarily were white, non-Pacific Islander, non-Indian, Asian, and Indian. And now I actually am a co-founder and co-owner of a small general contracting firm, and our applicants are primarily white, Hispanic, and Asian. So what? And we on purpose don't just hire from our network. We publicly advertise on Craigslist. And so I'm wondering, what is the role of a private firm to increase diversity versus the public's investment in individuals to broaden the applicant base? And number two is women, the lack of women. There's a really interesting book out now, right now, by Marianne Cooper that does a study of 50 families in Silicon Valley. And she found that upper-income families, which have, they tend to have two, both parents have college degrees or graduate degrees, and as they increase up the income scale, the fathers tend to focus on finance, and both parents are very worried about the potential success of their children. They don't feel like there's no longer a guarantee that as an American you'll be successful and their kids may not do as well as they have. Mm-hmm. That the women tend to, these educated women stay home in order to then develop their children's ability to succeed in this significantly more competitive world. So is there perhaps self-selecting out of the workforce and other priorities as these couples increase up the income scale and they no longer need dual incomes to survive and be successful?
Hey, Jason, I'm going to hold you right there. Thank you for the question. Let me put that to Danilo Campos and then Nicole Sanchez.
So this actually hits on something that's really important. It certainly affects women and it affects a lot of folks who are underrepresented in this industry. When you look at the numbers, the attrition rates, especially for women, are dramatically elevated as compared to their male peers. And so you have to look at why that happens. And when you talk to folks who are in this industry, a lot of the reason that they leave is that it is unpleasant to be the lone representative of your group, your values, your way of thinking in a place that can often be very hostile to that. So it's not just that people don't want to keep being in there. It's that it's not fun to keep being in there after a long time.
Nicole?
Well, I want to take the first part of the question about opening the applicant pool. The caller is absolutely correct that we need to fix a very leaky pipeline into tech, and that is all along the education system, and it mirrors the challenges that our schools are facing right now. You know, if you don't finish algebra by 7th or 8th grade, your chances of ever ending up in a computer science program diminish greatly. And we're talking, you know, then about the hidden biases and implicit biases in education system. And so, yes, it is leaky all along into tech. And that is true. So that your applicant pool is smaller. However, what I really appreciated that the caller said is that they don't just hire within their network. And one of the things that I would love to wave a magic wand in Silicon Valley and get rid of is referral bonuses, excuse me. So that when somebody says, oh, I know someone who could fill that position, and if that person is hired and that person succeeds for 6 months, I then get, you know, a $1,500 bonus. Well, people don't hang out in diverse groups. They don't know people unlike them. And so you're going to reap what you sow. So I really appreciate that the caller said one of the ways that they're expanding the pipeline or their applicant pool is by being very proactive outside their networks. That's why I like to highlight a lot of the programs that are graduating CS majors of color.
We've got a lot of great comments coming through. And Eric Abrams from UC Berkeley, I want to put two of these online comments to you. Greg writes, your program jumps straight to the assumption that racism is the driving factor for the composition of the tech workforce, but ignores the glaringly obvious fact that one cannot recruit large numbers of minorities for tech jobs if there are only small numbers of minorities with the proper training. Sean writes, whites and Asians dominate college campuses, especially in tech majors. If we want more non-Asian minorities in tech companies, we need to reach out and get more non-Asian minorities in tech majors in colleges. Eric Abrams, what do you make of that?
Well, I think that there's a gross oversimplification there. I mean, you know, I don't know that whites and Asians dominate the science and engineering departments at, say, Morehouse College or Spelman College or Texas El Paso.
To some historically black colleges.
Right. I do think that education is part of the problem. As Nicole said, if you don't take algebra in middle school, it's going to be very difficult to go forward. Another problem that I think is the economics of education. Even when I look at the students that we have graduating from the MBA program at Haas, if they've got significant student debt, they're less likely to go the startup route than to go into an established company. Because they can't afford it. And then you take the students who don't have a huge safety net, you know, of parents who have a high level of affluence, they're definitely not going to go the startup route. They're going to go to something established. The other thing that I'd like to mention that we haven't talked about is regional demographics. In other words, there are, you know, cities of this country, I'm specifically speaking of African Americans now, but there are areas like the Atlanta area or the DC area or the Chicago area that have high populations of African American folks, but not as much penetration in the tech industry. When we look at the Bay Area in general and Silicon Valley in particular, it's not a historical mecca for African Americans, and that might be one of the reasons why we don't see as many people in the companies.
And our region's African American population is decreasing, moving further out from the populated areas. In fact, California's black population is projected to go from 4%, where it is now, to 2% by the year 2040. So there are definitely some economic factors there. I want to go back to the phones in just a moment, but I wanted to mention that Nicole Sanchez mentioned a program at Hartnell College that is reaching out to the children of the largely migrant farm worker community in I believe it's Monterey and Salinas. KQED education reporter Anatin Tokalis did a story on that program as part of the American Graduate Initiative with the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. I just tweeted out the link. If you search for me on Twitter, my name is Joshua Johnson. I'm the one who works at KQED. You'll find the link there. KQED's Anatin Tokalis did that article and has more information on that program. Let's go back to the phones with Maria Noel in San Jose. Maria Noel, good morning.
Good morning. I want to bring in the subcontracted workforce into this conversation. What we really do know is that there are people of color. They're just in food service, at the Google, Apple, all-you-can-eat bars. They're the security officers, the janitors, bus drivers. They're in low-wage jobs at these major tech companies. And if these companies really wanted to do something about lifting up people of color, particularly Latinos and blacks, and addressing this, quote, diversity issue, they would start with creating job standards for those people of color who are already at their campuses, who are struggling to make ends meet, that are subcontracted by these companies, and who are completely ignored and are in the shadows of this diversity in tech debate.
Very true. Maria Noel, thanks for calling in on that. And actually, I should note, HP, Hewlett-Packard, puts out a Global Citizenship Report every year. Well, it used to be called Global Citizenship. I'm not sure what it's called now. But it's an annual report that includes the demographics of their workforce. They've been publishing this for years, since way before Reverend Jackson made this request. If you look at HP's report, it does break down by professionals, office workers, clerical workers, laborers, and technicians. It's a much more detailed breakdown than the reports even that have been coming from other tech companies. Eric Abrams, did you want to chime in on that?
Right. I think Maria makes a really good point. And one thing that has happened in Silicon Valley over the years is it seems that structured leadership development programs have lost popularity. The sort of management training, executive training, we see the potential here and we're going to teach this young woman, this young man how to grow in our company. Well, programs like that can be a great way to invest in developing rising stars, including minority talent, female talent, LGBT talent, and non-minority talent. But without those sorts of programs, it's easy for people to I like the company, but I'm not going to rise through it. I'll go do something else.
Danilo, I want to put this email comment to you. Michael writes, calling this racism is unjust. Bigotry is a human challenge that afflicts nearly all of us. Yes, some ethnic groups are selected out, others in. Still, there's no reason to expect diversity in Silicon Valley. We deify white guys and demonize them too. Expecting people to stretch to reach out to higher outgroup people is a nice hope, but not racism.
Well, that's a fun one.
That's why I gave it to you.
So there's a few pieces of this. The point that you hear a lot in startup circles is that we have a talent shortage. We can't find the people we need to do these jobs. These are hard jobs. What are we going to do about the fact that no one can hire? Well, the talent shortage is a myth because there are smart people out there waiting to be hired, enthusiastic to be hired. You know, I think the point about the lack of leadership training and developments inside of tech companies is an important one. But I would go further. The lack of professional development, period, is very pernicious. So if one thing you'll hear in startup land is the myth of the 10X engineer.
And the 10X, the 10X engineer?
The 10X engineer, this vaunted unicorn that when you find them, this one person can give you 10 times the output of what a standard engineer can do. And so what happens is that you have companies that are going around looking for this perfect engineer instead of saying, you know what, we're going to find people who can learn, we're going to hire them, and we're going to develop them into exactly the sort of star players who we need. And this is really frustrating on a couple points. When you look at most startups, the problems that they're attempting to solve are not quote-unquote hard computer science problems. There's a handful that do. There's a handful that will need to at some point in their development.
Like genuinely groundbreaking CS problems.
Right. Or scaling problems because, you know, you're Twitter and you are suddenly in a position where a whole bunch of people, you know, are using your service at once and nobody's actually solved for that kind of thing before. So occasionally you're going to bump into those. But the vast majority of problems that are being solved by startups are user experience problems, business problems, systems integration problems. And so for those things, you don't need necessarily 4 or 5 years of hardcore computer science training. You need an ability to learn because whatever you learned in school, so much of the top level stuff is going to be out of date anyway. You need an ability to learn new things and to be able to stay on that learning track over the course of a career.
I got to get back to the phones. Let's go to Del Del in San Francisco. Del Del, good morning.
Good morning. Thank you so much for having this program. And hi, Danilo. Hi, Nicole. I just wanted to...
She just waved at you from the studio, by the way. I think you should know.
I just wanted to say thank you, Danilo, for mentioning the product market fit, because that's something that we hear a lot of in startup land, that we really need to be able to understand our core customer. But guess what? Latinos are the majority of Californians right now. So I am your target customer. So if you don't have somebody on your team that's able to understand what my needs are and how I'm going to interact with your product, before you write a line of code, you need to understand that, because otherwise you're wasting people's time, money, and effort, and you're going to frustrate me as a customer, and I'm not going to go back to your program. And the other thing is that, you know, we're really doing it for ourselves, that, you know, while it, some of the comments that have come through of saying, like, diversity is not needed and all that, well, guess what? I think diversity is needed. I've been working in tech since 1990, and I'm tired of being the only one. So we're doing it for ourselves. You know, kudos to the Monos and all the other NUMMI Accelerator and all of those other people who are out there doing it. But, you know, I've launched the Latina Startup Tour. We're going across the U.S., and we're doing one-day workshops on lean startup methodology, and we're launching here in Oakland on August 23rd at Oakstop. Hope to see some people there. That would be great. But the reality is that not everybody lives within the tech bubble. There's a lot of people outside of Silicon Valley who want to create products and want to solve problems. And they're out there learning on their own, just like Danilo did and a lot of people are. And then one of the other things is investment. The reality is that also we have our own people who have money and they need to start investing in ourselves. Mm-hmm. So whether you're black, brown, or purple, if you really want to invest in companies that are going to grow and scale and make money, you need to invest in people who are going to solve the problems of everyday people. And we are everyday people. I am not some sort of minority. I'm a woman and I'm Latina. And guess what? I'm the majority. So make a product for me. I'll engage with you. It'll help your company grow. But for those investors that are out there, which is one of the reasons I would say kudos to Monos, it's
right,
like,
right.
we're actually training people on how to become investors and how to be able to work in this world.
Del, I hate to cut you short, but I appreciate the comment. Thank you very much for calling in. I got to get to a few more of the online comments. Maggie writes, I apologize if you've already covered this. We haven't. But can you ask your panel about opportunities for LGBT individuals in tech company employment and any relevant resources? Nicole Sanchez?
Sure. I'd love to tell you about one of my favorite organizations. It's called TransHack. And before I get to it, I would like to say that I think that the reality in tech companies as it is across the country in all fields is that we've got LGB and then a long pause and then T. And I think that the challenges faced by the LGB cisgendered community is different than those faced by the transgender community. So I want to just put that out there. And in so saying, I really love an organization called TransHack, which is about gender nonconforming, gender creative folks who are in Silicon Valley coming together for weekends to solve problems that their community is facing. And it was started by Dr. Courtney Ziegler, and it's a wonderful, wonderful program. And everybody who identifies this way even if you're not a hacker, is invited to come and help try and solve real problems via technology for that community. And, I think folks are looking for jobs out of that and looking to hire other people. And I just love that organization very, very much.
We're almost out of time for this hour. It's been an amazing conversation. I want to go around the table from each of you and just get the one best thing. If a company is listening right now, they're like, okay, I want to help. What do I do? The one best thing a company can do right now to turn this tide, to increase the diversity of their workforce, starting with you, Eric. What's the one best thing, briefly?
Long-term strategy would be invest in education.
Invest in education. Nicole?
Articulate how diversity has an impact on your business plan overall.
And Danilo?
I have no messages for companies. They know what they're getting wrong. My message is for everyone out there who wants to be part of this. There is no one who can stop you. The moment you decide that you want to build something, you can make it happen. I'm sorry that the road is going to be rough, but you can make magic happen for yourself if you work hard and put your work out there into the world.
Got it. I really appreciate all the thoughts, questions, comments to all of those of you who wrote in. Please keep the conversation going online. Sorry we couldn't hit on every kind of diversity there is out there. We're trying to take a little bite of this. And again, if you did want to talk more about age discrimination, alleged age discrimination in Silicon Valley, check the forum archives. Eric Abrams of UC Berkeley, thanks for talking to us. Mobile designer Danilo Campos, thank you for being here. And Nicole Sanchez of Via Consulting, we really appreciate your time. Forum is produced by Judy Campbell, Irene Noguchi, and Tina Laubert. Our engineer is Danny Bringer. We get online support from David Marks. Our senior editor is Dan Zoll. Our interns are Leslie Chang, Kathy Shield, Hannah Kingsley Ma, Charlie Zaharoff, Eric Nygaard, and Kaylin Dakin. I'm Joshua Johnson of KQED News, sitting in for Michael Krasny. Thank you so much for listening. This is Forum from KQED Public Radio.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation.